The Guardian.
Boris Johnson breaks a couple of promises in order to keep another. He's raising taxes to tackle NHS backlogs and deal with social care. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
This will raise almost £36 billion over the next 3 years, with money from the levy going directly to health and social care across the whole of our United Kingdom.
The Prime Minister has broken one of the Conservative Party's key manifesto promises with a whacking £12 billion worth of tax increases to pay for the NHS and social care, telling voters the pandemic wasn't in anyone's manifesto.
Yes, I accept that this breaks a manifesto commitment, which is not something I do lightly, but a global pandemic was in no one's manifesto.
Labour isn't happy, and neither are the Tory backbenchers. But will voters punish Johnson for broken promises or reward him for taking what he called the tough decisions? And later on, we'll be talking about green politics in the UK as we gear up for a leadership election in the Green Party in England and Wales, and Scotland gets its first green ministers. With COP26 coming up in November in Glasgow, is this the Green Party's moment? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Parliament is back with a bang. To talk about everything that's happened this week, I'm joined by Guardian columnist Zoe Williams. Zoe, thanks very much for joining me. We're really sort of back to a political new term with a bang this week, aren't we? This announcement from Boris Johnson yesterday, it felt to me like a sort of budget day almost. There was so much packed into it. It's quite a big moment, isn't it?
Well, it's a big moment in the sense that he's obviously heard and ignored not just the kind of ambient objections to this plan, but the objections from within his own party. And there were reports at the weekend that he was in invincible mode. I mean, have you ever heard of a more terrifying phrase? Boris Johnson in invincible mode. He's kind of stopped listening to the objections. So in that sense, yes, it felt bigger than a press conference. It felt like a kind of more significant and substantial announcement. In terms of detail, no, there wasn't a lot packed into it because there was a huge amount of flex in what sounded like a kind of solid plan. It was by no means clear what was left over for social care after they've put that money into the NHS to clear the backlog. It was by no means clear when the backlog will be cleared. If you were sitting down with your calculator as a social care apparatchik trying to work out how much more you would have to spend, I think you'd have a job.
And so we just run us through it. So who's going to have to pay for this £12 billion a year and how much and when?
The way it's raked, and it's really peculiar, a little bit confusing, because as you know, national insurance, when you're earning over £50,000, goes down to 2% rather than 12%. So the net result of that is that if you're on £20,000, you'll pay £130 more a year. If you're on £100,000, you'll pay £1,130 more a year. So as the additional yearly payment of this 1.25 percentage point raise is proportionally less the more you earn. As a proportion of your income, the amount that's taxable is at its greatest at about 40 or 50 grand when it's 10%. They did avoid one massive pitfall, which was that pensioners, because they don't pay, even if they're still working, they don't pay national insurance, that they wouldn't be hit by the rise. But actually, pensioners who are still working will pay this rise. They just don't pay national insurance otherwise. And of course, businesses will pay the other half of the national insurance. But so it's actually a 2.5% rise, but the other 1.25 will be paid by businesses. I mean, it is quite plainly a burden on the working age population.
And what's behind this, Zoe? Why have they decided, you know, the Conservatives traditionally think of themselves as being a low tax party. They made an explicit promise in 2019 in the general election not to raise national insurance or a bunch of other taxes too. Why have they decided to go down this route, do you think?
Well, I think we're kind of falling into their own narrative, which I'm slightly unwilling to do. It's absolutely true that what they all said, what Sunak, Sajid Javid and Boris Johnson said, which was that things will have to be paid for. But what they're relying on is that we all see tax as just, you know, a thing. The Tories don't like the thing, but they have to do the thing. Therefore, we all just have to suck up the thing. But the truth is not, the tax is not just one nebulous, amorphous thing. It's you choose who to tax and why and when. What we're looking at is quite an incremental increase to national insurance, which now is about to reach double what it was 10 years ago. That does say something quite significant about where the tax burden falls. And it's extraordinary. The more you think about it, the more extraordinary it is. The tax burden is now falling more heavily upon the low-paid workers than it is on almost anybody else, let alone pensioners. And I think that is going to kind of, I think that more than the broken promise of, you know, the low tax party actually putting taxes up is what's going to bite them in the end.
Yeah, do you think that's the strongest territory for Labour, the sort of fairness argument, you know, who should bear the costs of this?
But also Labour needs to really be thinking about the fact that the Tory gains among working age people were really marginal. So the bloodbath red wall election, when the red wall turned blue, that election was not won on working people's votes. It was won on pensioners turning out more and working age people not turning out. So Labour has everything to gain from working age people. So Labour's fixated with like winning back those people with their conservative values. Labour needs to make a promise. It needs to make a new contract with people who are working, which thinks bigger and goes further than Blair and Brown. Because in the whole time of, you know, all the way through New Labour, they were having so many conversations about child poverty. They were never having a conversation about wages. And they explicitly admit that now. That's where they need to go. And I don't think it's that hard.
And Zoe, do you think the broken promises argument works? So Boris Johnson kind of embraced yesterday the idea, or acknowledged the idea, that he'd broken a manifesto promise. And he said, well, you know, COVID wasn't in anybody's manifesto either. You know, do you think voters buy that explanation, that excuse from the Prime Minister? And do you think it's right for Labour, profitable for Labour, to keep sort of hammering the idea that they've broken their promises?
Nobody wants to sound like, in political discussion or political commentary, and this goes with, I'm not talking about the commentariat, I'm talking about voters, is naive or victimised. Nobody's going to go out up to you in a vox pop and say, I trusted Boris Johnson and he's let me down, because that would make you sound like an idiot. So there's a huge tolerance for broken promises from him as a particular man. And then add in the fact that everybody understands that COVID was a completely untoward event that nobody planned for. You know, I mean, you can get on your high horse and say pandemics aren't completely unpredictable and plenty of people predicted this. But what you can't do, I don't think, and stay credible, is say, if I'd been in government, I would have known that the pandemic was coming, because nobody would believe you. So I'm not sure how well those arguments stick. In fact, you know, I don't think they stick well at all. Broken promises and the dishonesty generally, they're not a workable smoking gun if that's all you've got to say. But if you set yourself up in contrast to that and say, I am a person of my word, I will keep my promises, and you need somebody in these times, indeed in all times, who isn't a joker, who isn't a liar, that can work. So really, it's about working the critique into building a picture of yourself rather than launching critique after critique.
And Zoe, there was strikingly little detail, as you said, in the government's plan about what they're actually, you know, how they're going to spend this money and what they hope to achieve in terms of overhauling the social care system in particular. And social care sort of came quite a long way down the list, it seemed to me, when they were describing it. You know, it gets less than £6 billion over the first 3 years of the plan. And Sajid Javid couldn't say how much or what proportion of the £12 billion it would get after that, because the first priority seems to be fixing NHS waiting lists. I mean, we still don't really know what's intended for social care. Do we accept the implementation of this cap on lifetime costs?
As a social care plan, it's looking through the wrong end of the telescope. I mean, it's looking through the end of the telescope in which the only interest group are the people who may have to sell their house to pay for it or may not. But there's also, you know, you have to look at it from the point of view of the people who work in the sector. They talked very briefly about upskilling them, which is absolute lunacy as far as I'm concerned, because you won't meet anybody more skilled than a care worker. What the sector needs is a system of skill recognition so that you can progress career-wise. At the moment, you'll meet carers who've been doing it for 25 years who are still on exactly the same wages, sometimes less than they were when they started, because there's no system of career progression and the financial model is broken.
So do you think there will be a sort of slow dawning realisation with people that you know, the problems in the system haven't been fixed? I mean, it doesn't come in, that cap itself doesn't start to be implemented, does it, until October 2023, apart from anything else. So anyone going to the system for the next couple of years will still face the same problem. But do you think people at the sharp end will start to realise that you know, Boris Johnson claims to have sort of fixed this? He uses that language and they really haven't.
Well, I mean, I think basically it's sort of a tip. At the moment, we have a kind of Conservative government whose only long-term interest is in replicating its own electoral power and rhetorical power. I don't think, even if there were a good plan for social care, I don't think they would enact it. I just don't think they're competent to be that kind of government that has a plan and then enacts it. I think it's a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Zoe, we heard a lot in the run-up to this announcement about potential sort of backlash. There were certainly some unhappy cabinet ministers. There were a lot of unhappy MPs. But in the end, yesterday, after it was announced in the House of Commons, actually, you know, barely any MPs stood up and criticised it. Most of them sort of praised Johnson or at the very least, you know, raised an eyebrow and but then made clear they would knuckle under and support it. What's going on there, do you think? Is he just riding high in his party? Does the threat of a potential reshuffle help, do you think, to keep people in line?
You know what Tory backbenchers are like. They're all gong and no dinner. There is an irresistible momentum to a government with a majority this large, because in order for a rebellion to be significant, you have to marshal so many people and make them all hold their nerve all at the same time. You know, if you're talking about 20, you can imagine a kind of single interest group in Parliament numbering 20 MPs from one party. But they have to get 40 rebels. Even with the invention of WhatsApp or Signal, that's still more than most rebellions can muster. They just don't have what it takes to cause a serious problem for the government and their inner circle. They're not Eurosceptics. They are Eurosceptic, but they don't have that same pedigree of troublemaking that the 1922 lot made such hay with in the 90s and noughties.
Zoe, I'm told we could still possibly get a reshuffle, perhaps not this week, but maybe before the party conferences, which will be in the next kind of couple of weeks or so. There are quite a few ministers. It would be, what can I say without being... too pejorative. Are there some you'd quite like to see the back of?
I mean, I don't. I mean, I have a horrible "be careful what you wish for" sensation, even considering this. I'm not saying it could be worse, but I am saying it could be in no way better. You know, the line seems to be solidifying that Johnson can't reshuffle because he's using everybody as a human shield, whether that's Hancock or Rob or, you know, even the only person who isn't working for him as a human shield is Sunak, who seems to get kind of a lot of credit and no critique. I'm not sure that how much it would help. I'm not sure how much it would help Johnson politically, because it's not as though... It's not as though he's kind of hit some doldrums and he can get rid of people and his own ratings will suddenly go through the roof. The truth is, anything at the moment, he's relying heavily on these on his senior ministers to take the fall, and he who knows whether that, as a strategy, I haven't seen it work before, but nor have I seen it brought down.
We'll see. Zoe Williams, thanks ever so much for joining me.
Cheers.
After the break, Peter Walker and Libby Brooks tell me what's next for Green Party politics in the UK. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, it might have been recess, but it's been a busy time for the Green Party in England and Wales and in Scotland. To give me all the latest, I spoke to Peter Walker, our political correspondent in Westminster, and our Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks in Glasgow. So, Peter, thanks for joining us. And we're also going to talk to Libby Brooks, our Scotland correspondent. But first, Peter, perhaps we could start with you. The Green Party are riding high in the polls at the moment, aren't they?
There was a poll out the day before we recorded this, which put them actually above the Lib Dems. I mean, that's not been seen for a while, but they were on 10%. as against the Lib Dems 9. They do tend to go kind of up and down in the polls. And when it gets to the general election, it doesn't necessarily benefit them that much. But this is really kind of good news. And it's interesting to wonder why. You know, I almost wonder if perhaps the Extinction Rebellion protests might be focusing people's minds on the climate emergency and things like that. But you know, even when they're not up at 10, they've been bumping it around about 5 or 6%, which for the Greens is actually reasonably good.
Let's sort of take one step back. And we know that obviously they stand for tackling the climate crisis and tackling it much more urgently. You know, give us a sense more broadly of what their sort of policies are. You know, how would they go about that, and what's their approach to other sort of political social issues?
I mean, the interesting thing about the Greens is obviously the climate emergency stuff people know them for, but they're getting more well known for their kind of general economic and social justice things. And you know, one of the kind of curses of being a Green is that they come up with ideas. People kind of laugh at them for a year, then they think about them for a couple of years, and they get taken on by other parties. So take, for example, the idea of people working a four-day week. It was the Greens, certainly in the UK, who first came up with that. And everyone thought, oh my goodness, this is, you know, completely crazy. But the Greens are perhaps the only party who are thinking seriously about the future of work, about this kind of technologized decades we're going into, and how we're going to, you know, live in this period when there's perhaps not enough work for people to do. But it's about, you know, the future of work. It's about equality. It's about tackling inequalities in wealth. It's all sorts of stuff. And you know, they're quite keen to not just be defined by this one thing.
And Peter, there's a leadership race going on at the moment, isn't there? A contested leadership race in the Green Party for the first time in quite a while.
Well, they've been contested in the past, but someone told me that this is about the first time in a decade it's not been completely obvious who was going to win. There's two duos who are very, very much, you know, seen as the front runners, but it's almost completely 50-50 between the two of them.
And what are the issues, Peter, that it's being fought over?
It's as much symbolic as anything else, because you have on the one side this duo of Carla Denyer and Adrian Ramsey, both of whom are kind of quite long-term activists and have been parliamentary candidates quite a few times. Carla Denyer is seen as perhaps their next big chance of getting a parliamentary win. And on the other side, you've got Amelia Womack, who's been the deputy leader for about 7 years, and Tamsin Ormond, who was one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion. And even though Amelia Womack is obviously quite an establishment figure in, you know, Green terms, having been the deputy leader, they're seen almost as perhaps the representatives of the younger, perhaps more protest-based groups. There is quite a long and complicated argument about trans rights, which most people basically agree on. It's about, you know, how it's implemented within the party. You know, it's actually turning out to be quite a feisty battle so far.
Interesting. And are they in a position, do you think, to win many more seats at the next general election? They're of course, you know, if you have 10% support, but it's evenly spread across the whole country, it's incredibly problematic, isn't it? And you know, do they have many chances of gaining more seats than that Brighton one that Caroline Lucas has held for some time?
Yeah, I mean, they've had Caroline Lucas's seat since 2005, but they've not been able to expand it since then. Carla Denyer is seen as perhaps an outside shot to win one of the Bristol seats at the next election. I mean, the curse for the Greens is obviously first past the post. You know, the Lib Dems and other smaller parties to an extent suffer from this too. The Greens has almost got it worse, that even if they did keep at 10% in the polls, you know, which would be doing really, really well, they would do extremely well to win one or perhaps two seats. So the best hope that they've got is to kind of keep on plugging away and hope another party gets into power, or maybe they help another party in power. And then you get proportional representation coming in. A Green party that can poll 8-10% in the polls will start to get a reasonable number of MPs, and then will just grow, and then people won't feel it's a wasted vote. Because if you live in a very safe Labour or Conservative seat, or particularly if you're in a kind of marginal where it's been, you know, battled out between, I don't know, Tories and Lib Dems or Labour and Tories, then there can be a sense that voting Green can be a waste. So they're completely scuppered by the electoral system.
Libby, that brings us very neatly, doesn't it, to the situation in Scotland, where the Scottish Green Party is completely separate, isn't it, from its English counterpart? But it does have the benefit of a proportional system, at least for Holyrood, and is on its way into an agreement with the SNP.
The Scottish Government has reached a proposed cooperation agreement with the Scottish Greens, working together to build a greener, fairer, independent Scotland is groundbreaking. groundbreaking in both Scottish and perhaps even more so UK politics.
Absolutely. Well, it's in agreement with the SNP government as of the end of last month, when the leaders, Nicola Sturgeon, and the leaders of the Scottish Greens, Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater, made this grand announcement at Bute House. A lot has been made of the historic nature of this deal. You know, it's the first time that the Greens have been in government anywhere in the UK. Nicola Sturgeon has said repeatedly that this is about being seen to do politics differently, and that the agreement is based on a spirit of cooperation and consensus building. There's certainly a lot of fanfare around this agreement. To be clear, it's not a traditional coalition. The Greens have secured a series of opt-outs for themselves on policies that they feel they just can't agree with the Scottish Government on, for example, on green ports, on aviation. The scrutiny that the Scottish Green Party is now going to be under in terms of sort of every sort of large government decision, I think that is going to sort of bring with it its own pressures as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're speaking, Libby, before Nicola Sturgeon presents her programme for government at Holyrood. Do you think we'll get a sense of that from that this is a sort of green-tinged government, you know, that the Greens have got something for these compromises they're going to have to make?
Yeah, I mean, we've already got that sense from the deal itself. It was very detailed in terms of what the two parties are proposing, putting forward for this next 5-year term. I don't think there'll be any sort of fantastic surprises in the PFG, aside from the fact that we'll just get a bit more of a sense of what they are prioritising. More broadly, in terms of the deal that the parties worked out, you know, for the rest of the term, it's very, very early days in terms of that sort of green tinge. You had Friends of the Earth saying that they sort of were feeling cautiously optimistic about it in terms of the Greens being able to sort of pull the SNP more towards being more radical on climate.
And do you think there'll be a risk, Libby, that the voters end up punishing the Greens? You know, we saw with the Westminster government, the Lib Dem Conservative coalition, you almost felt at the subsequent election that the Lib Dems were sort of punished more harshly for the decisions the Conservatives had made than the Tories were, because they'd gone into government with them. And, you know, at least you knew the Tories were Tories, but this wasn't what we expected from the Lib Dems kind of thing. Do you think there's a risk that they get sort of hung on them, unpopular decisions that the government makes?
I think inevitably a lot of Scottish Greens are sort of looking back and quailing at the experience of Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats. I mean, again, I guess I would just sort of reiterate the fact it's not a traditional coalition, in the fact that, in the sense that there are these sort of opt-outs for the policies that there isn't going to be agreement on. It was interesting at this Holyrood election just gone, how much the Scottish Greens made of their sort of ability to influence the SNP from out with government. You know, they pushed them on free school meals for primary kids, an eviction ban during the pandemic, increasing public sector pay in the most recent budget. You know, they had some really significant wins, and so it's going to be very interesting to see what they're able to bring to the electorate in 5 years from now, and whether that that list of sort of influences is as convincing. Certainly, I would say that the SNP gets a great, well, it appears at the moment that the SNP gets a great deal more out of this than potentially the Greens do. But at the end of the day, they are also in government. And have two ministers in government for the first time. So we'll see what they do.
And Peter, I'm sure just to come back to you quickly, I'm sure the Green Party south of the border will be watching extremely closely to see what happens to that agreement and how that goes.
I think it's a really interesting time for the Green Party in England and Wales, because they are, to an extent, you know, governing on a low level. And in the Westminster Parliament, I mean, they basically would most likely have to wait for proportional representation. You could potentially see a scenario where you have such a finely balanced Commons that one or two Green MPs could make all the difference. They're basically playing a longer game. They're just showing that they can build up power at councils, that they can use power well, and then just get treated as this serious alternative political party.
And Libby, presumably the Greens in government in Scotland will be very keen to highlight the COP26 conference that's coming up very soon, and put pressure on both the Scottish government and the Westminster government to try and ensure we get some progress there.
I think that will certainly be concentrating minds across the UK. It's interesting up here. I think at the moment it's less a question of where the Scottish Greens are going to fit in, but does the Scottish government fit in at all? We've had Boris Johnson saying previously that all the devolved administrations should be involved in the conference, but then over the weekend we've had these leaked messages from Downing Street showing that Number 10 is trying to sideline Nicola Sturgeon from the summit over concerns that she would hijack it to push for Scottish independence. Sort of advisers saying that Johnson shouldn't be seen sharing a platform with Sturgeon in the run-up to the event, and that she should be neutralised by including all the other devolved leaders wherever possible. Now, it's... It is a constant moan up here that everything ends up being seen through the lens of the Constitution, and I think it would be gutting on a whole new level if COP26 ended up getting pulled into the constitutional mind as well.
And of course, Peter, you talked about Extinction Rebellion protests making these issues more sort of salient and making the public think about them more. Of course, that will be hugely multiplied when the COP26 conference is happening very soon, won't it?
That is very true. And Extinction Rebellion are not the kind of protest arm of the Green Party. But particularly if Tamsin Omond becomes one of their co-leaders, the links will be that much more. And I think very, very much when it comes to COP26, the party in England and Wales feel that it's kind of their role to hold Boris Johnson's feet to the fire over the promises that he makes. I think they very, very much expect him to make a big show of promising a lot of stuff, but for COP to not actually necessarily achieve that much. And it's going to be interesting to see how much they do yoke themselves to Extinction Rebellion, particularly over things like this, because Extinction Rebellion are obviously quite a divisive group, that they're very, very popular amongst the young. But there's also polling that show that, amongst the population at large, they're the, least popular protest group in the UK. And for the Greens in England and Wales, that's going to be a little bit of a test. And, COP26 might be a way that they, show what they do.
Definitely one to watch in both north and south of the border, I think. Peter Walker and Libby Brooks, thanks both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all from us this week. Make sure to listen to Friday's episode of Politics Weekly Extra, as Jonathan Friedland talks to Moira Donegan about what last week's Supreme Court decision means for abortion rights in the US and how the political world is responding. If you have any time free between this episode and Friday's, then please subscribe and leave us a review. But for now, I want to thank our guests Zoe Williams, Peter Walker and Libby Brooks. The producer is Hattie Moyer. I'm Heather Stewart. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.